Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. This is the second in a series of discussions that invites guests to talk about their home, their work, and their ideas in our state, California. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning we will be talking to Susanna Hecht, a senior professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs at the University of California, Los Angeles. Professor Hecht is a leader in any number of academic fields. She's a graduate of UC Berkeley, where she earned her PhD. Her field is political ecology. She writes on environmental and social history of the tropics, but is interested in forestation more widely. Her latest book is the forthcoming Scramble for the Amazon, University of Chicago Press. She's received support from the National Science Foundation, the MacArthur and Guggenheim Foundations, as well as the Institute for Advanced Studies. So, Professor Hecht, lots to talk about.
Good morning.
Good morning, and good morning to you. Susanna, you told me that one of your best-known books, The Fate of the Forest, is now in its fourth printing. It's in the top 10 rainforest books, so let's begin with that.
So let me talk a little bit about Fate of the Forest. What's interesting about it, and its durability has been remarkable and very pleasing because, you know, you spend a lot of time on these things and you hate for them to spend their rest of their lives sort of being dusty in bookshelves. But what it really talks about is, first of all, it's an environmental history, and it's one of the earliest environmental histories that we find in Latin America. People were sort of, if you think about that time, people wrote a lot about political history and Cold War, the relationship of, you know, the United States to the rise of authoritarian regimes and so on. But very little attention was being given to the whole question of the environment as an environmental history as a topic. How stuff tends to get reported is sort of in disparate little chunklets, you know. So there'll be Henry Ford is in the Amazon, and Teddy Roosevelt was in the Amazon, and the Daniel Ludwig's in the Amazon. So you'll have like little chunklets, and then there'll be the NGO rainforest campaigns, but you don't ever get from this a kind of a coherent story about the history of politics and how it plays out in the environment. The thing that was also important about this book, and I think it's become more important if you actually were to look at the Amazon map, you'd see that about 60% of the Amazon now is in some form of conservation, and of that, really about 60% of that is in sort of land classifications that allow people to be in them. Unlike our models, what's called in the biz the Muirist model, based on John Muir's idea of natural landscapes that don't have people in them and are to be maintained in some kind of pristine imaginary, the real contribution that came out of the period in the 1980s and 1990s was, and from the Amazon, was the idea of inhabited environments as having a lot of conservation value. In fact, being more able to handle incursions from any other type than classic parks, which are always being invaded and other kinds of things that were happening. The other significant thing about this book is that it describes both the sort of anti-authoritarian movement in Brazil, which had a huge environmental content to it, and also the question of Chico Mendes, who really is the person who's behind this idea of inhabited landscapes through the idea of extractive reserves. So what you had actually is this extraordinary transformation in how people thought about environment in Latin America and the role of social movements. If you look at at the Amazon map now about where areas that are protected, what you would see is that it's all sort of an outcome of social movements. It's the indigenous movement, it's the traditional people's movements, and it's the environmental movement. So in a relatively short space of time, they've been able to make phenomenal achievements. And just to sort of continue along this line, sort of thinking about Fate of the Forest as giving a sort of background, a background story, we now have a situation where deforestation in Amazonia has declined by 70% since 2004, which when, you know, this was inconceivable in the year 2000, where it was just seemed like it would just keep going at this exponential rate. What you've seen is an extraordinary transformation, which I think is one of the most optimistic stories one can imagine. This is not to say, by the way, that there isn't deforestation going on in the Amazon, but its rate has contracted enormously.
I just, if you could go back and just explain that 70%, what that really means on the ground.
Well, it means that, now let me just have a little caveat here, which is that, you know, yes, there are these big controversies about dams like Belo Monte, which is a big, huge damming of one of the largest tributaries of the Xingu River in the Amazon, and it's met with huge resistance and so on. It's not to say that there hasn't been deforestation from soybean. It's not to say that nothing, you know, that somehow it stopped as in, like, sort of in a freeze frame. It's that there's been huge processes of social change and institutional change and technological change and, perhaps most important of all, a political context that has permitted a kind of what they call in Brazil socio-environmentalism, socio-ambientalismo, to prevail in a lot of the political discussions about how the region's going to develop. Under the authoritarian period, it was sort of a Wall Street speculative, you know, throw a few cattle on, but really you were flipping the land and using the land itself to get access to other forms of capital and assets. So it's gone really in a stark shift away from what had been a really brutal speculative frontier into a frontier that is a lot more productive. The other thing is that there has been the emergence of a lot of commodities that actually are based on forest products. I think the one that, I don't know about you, but the one that perhaps many of your listeners might know about is acai, that's A-C-A-I, which comes from small-scale producers in the Amazonian estuaries, and it's one of those fashionable superfoods that we should all be eating so that we stay young forever. But this is one of these things, too, which is that you have had some market things that have worked in a positive direction. You have had more market boycotts that also worked in a positive direction. So Mafric and some other large supermarket chains began to follow commodity chains and say, well, we don't want stuff from the Amazon. We're not going to buy it. So in part from a Greenpeace movement in that began actually in the Netherlands and in Britain, they began to sort of follow a lot of food chains in these kind of globalized products and started to have a lot of influence via consumer boycotts in such a way that this actually changed sort of the dynamics of pasture expansion. So that's extremely important and interesting. And then you had this sort of livelihoods thing with traditional peoples in these areas where national markets for their commodities are emerging, but also that, you know, they have regional markets and local situations, but also a local politics. I don't want to get too into the neoliberal market saved everything because it didn't. What you had was a lot of politics that also produced a lot of new institutions and new institutionalities that permitted the kind of conservation that went on. In terms of technology, the other thing is, if you probably can't avoid this, but and particularly you guys up there. I used to live in southern Humboldt County, so I realize that there's a certain amount of contraband that's produced, that there's this kind of surveillance. And in Brazil, you have a kind of panopticon. You have a lot of people watching what's going on in that forest all the time and able to pinpoint land use changes in real time. So what happens is that IBAMA, which is, you know, if you're deforesting where you're not supposed to, you can get nailed by IBAMA. They can track, you know, movements of illegal mahogany and so on. So in a certain sense, I know this is Foucault in the forest here, and perhaps it's not the most wonderful thing. I'm always worried about surveillance, not because, although my life is a totally blank and virtuous sphere, but in this case, what you have is a situation where things are being watched all the time, and so that panopticon means that you can locate where illegal activities are going on that involve forest destruction. The other thing that it does, though, too, and this is very important, which is clearing land in order to claim it was really part of the big deal about deforestation, because you didn't have any way. Partly the legal system favored showing use, but the other thing is you didn't have, I mean, unless you happened to be a professional surveyor, there wasn't any way you could kind of tell what was going on with where your land ended and or not. Now, as you know, with GPS technologies and so on, you can actually very correctly identify where your physical boundaries of your land is. So let's say you were a perfectly wonderful person during the 1980s. Even if you wanted to not deforest in order to claim, you kind of had to. And now you have a mechanism where you can just do it with a smartphone and you know where your boundaries are. So that's another thing that's kind of helped. And finally, I would have to say, and then you can go on to another topic here. You can, as a professor, I often teach three-hour seminars, so I can go on for endless amounts of time and, you know, irritating detail. But I'll try and be quick on this one, which is that there's been a big institutional change. Property regimes are better. The political mechanisms through which disputes can be addressed are more responsive. And there is really a kind of national interest in Amazonia as a general thing, not as something that is to be destroyed, but as a sort of the way that we use national parks or nature in the United States as sort of like an identity thing, you know, that we have this portentous nature. And so that's made a difference. And then there's been, you know, with the political opening, there's been a huge amount of institutions, and also, this will come as a shock, Brazil actually has a climate policy and stuff. So they actually think about their role in global climates in a way that perhaps some places don't, I wouldn't want to say. But what it means is that, of course, Amazonia for them is also a way of offsetting their development in places like Sao Paulo. That is, it's, you know, in that larger scheme of things, they look at this as part of their carbon strategy, not just as part of an international one. And there's just been a lot of new institutions and a lot of new politics about this, and sort of, what can we say, sincere politics, that have produced a real transformation in the space of less than a decade. It's really remarkable.
Well, let me please say this is far from irritating. It's all too interesting. And if we had more time, we'd be happy to have a three-hour seminar.
Yes, I could go through it legislation by legislation. This would just...
But one thing, we really jumped into the Amazon here. We left the fate of the forest a bit behind. Did we get into your upcoming book, The Scramble for the Amazon?
We haven't, and I'm just doing my proofs now, so I could just speak now if you really want me to go into detail.
Well, let's
this
just
is
finish.
A little bit of,
let me go back.
A little bit of a different kind of book than Fate of the Forest.
Okay, we'll go back for a minute and just tell us again. Fate of the Forests, when was that published? And is it, you say
it's first published in 1989.
And it's published by?
University of Chicago Press.
Ah, and it's still available.
It's still available. Just, you know, its new edition is there for your reading pleasure.
And before we get to
and
this...
And it's been updated, by the way.
Okay.
So a lot of what I'm just talking about is in that book now.
Okay, and before we get then to your newest work, would you mind just telling us, you studied in the geography department at Berkeley. How did you get into this field? And maybe you could tell the listeners just a bit about what it's like, what you do as a researcher. Do you go to Brazil? Do you work in the field?
Why would one not, as they say? What a great opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, actually, my sort of the moment of Zen, I suppose, actually comes a little earlier when in a cold February in Chicago, where I was an undergraduate, and I was there at a time when there were very many distinguished tropical biologists. Daniel Jansen is probably the name that some of your listeners might know. But and also, it had a very good Latin American history program at the same time. And as is no longer required in lots of places, but is certainly required at Chicago, you had to take these sort of breadth requirements. And so you had to take a non-Western civilization. And I took Latin American history. So I was walking across in like one of these bitter days, which was a billion below zero with a really cold wind. And I was going from my tropical ecology class into my Latin American history class when I realized that they were both talking about the same place, one as though it had no human history and the other as though it had no biology. So in that moment, I said, this, as I say, the moment of Zen, which was like, oh, my God, this is really a very interesting thing. And if one could put these things together, you could have a far more interesting story to reveal than just the one or the other. So that was the moment of destiny. Now, geography, of course, has at its core the relationship with people and the environment. So even though we were all trained in, you know, what is the capital of Iowa, and don't ask me that, or where's the Crimea River, in essence, modern geography deals with questions about human impacts and human shaping of environment. In an earlier incarnation, it was also about how environments shape people. But that's a slightly different story. But it has this very core thing about how people make landscapes and how people represent landscapes and how landscape has meaning. So it's a different kind of, and it has had that in the entire time that it's had, well, let's say modern geography. So since the 19th century, it's come, that has been its topic. So that's why I ended up in geography. And it also gives you good science training and good social science training. So it's the ideal discipline. I'm putting a plug in for geography here, you might have noticed. It's the ideal discipline for dealing with contemporary problems, which all have an environmental component. So it's a great, and they are generous in their intellectual curiosity. You know, no one says, well, you know, that's a little too wacky. Why don't you just do something more relevant or something? So it has a generous intellectual heritage, which is very good for these kinds of things. In terms of the work that I did, I have been going back to the Amazon for a long time, and one of the things I was looking at was the impact of conversion of forest to pasture and its impact on soils. And so I took a lot of soil science and worked in a lab and had a lab while I did this work. It turned out to be kind of interesting because soils are a really good way to monitor land use change. Because if I sit and give you a list of species changes in tropical species, you will fall asleep in a nanosecond. You won't know what I'm talking about. But you can see friends in soil nitrogen or soil phosphorus. And even if you don't exactly know how that works, you can sort of get and have an intuition about how that system is functioning. Like if its phosphorus is going to zero, maybe that's not such a good thing, for example, just to be crude about it. So it's a rather easy tool for assessing environmental degradation or environmental resilience. You know, if it goes down and then comes back up, you've got some resilience dynamics. So how is that working? And then, so that's how I did that. And I've always been looking for alternatives to deforestation. And part of that ended up having me work with the Kayapo Indians with a wonderful anthropologist no longer in this incarnation called Daryl Posey. And one of the things we worked on was something that's called Terra Preta. If you may know about this, there's been some TV specials and stuff on it and special things in various magazines and journals. But this is basically what we call anthropogenic. That is, it comes out of human action, dark earths, and they're very dark. And the reason they're dark is they have char, just what we like on our steaks. But actually, this comes from a kind of cool burning, so that instead of getting that kind of hot burn where you volatilize everything, it creates a kind of active charcoal that holds on to nutrients. So it's very dark. At the time we were doing this study, we were looking at Kayapo soil management and sort of, you know, as sort of stumbled into the reality that they were burning all the time and not, you know, these big dramatic Sweden burns, but this low-level stuff that was going on all the time. Well, it turned out that that was the mechanism through which some black earths are maintained and how they're also produced. There's an urban dimension to this, too, and I won't go into it now because this will take hours. But so one of the things is that there were these mechanisms of sustainable soil management that occurred amongst the Kayapo. And since soils were degrading rapidly under the alternative models, this was considered to be really quite an important discovery. And there's been a kind of resurgence in this ever since. It's now seen as one of the most dynamic areas of tropical soil science, is looking at what goes on in these things. And also, you know, not only is it just that the nutrients are different, but they have really a different microflora. You know, it's like a different kind of soil in the midst of things. And it's what it shows is that human interaction with environments isn't just a story of endless degradation, which is what we get, but also it can be a story of husbandry and recuperation and creation of really positive dynamics. We have a big narrative about the tropics, about how everything is going to hell in a handbasket, but there are mechanisms of managing these systems that are actually quite durable and sustainable and, dare I use the term, improving.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm your host today on our program Talking About California. Our guest is Susanna Hecht. She's a senior professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA. We're talking about forests and the Amazon and what's happening in our forests. Maybe before we go back to the Amazon, I think I noticed that you have also done some writing in a Spanish language book, The Impacts of Migration. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Maybe we could do a lot
of work with some social movements in Central America.
So we'll move
so
to Central America.
I'm delighted to chat about that, because this is another place where, you know, the typical story is one of endless collapse. I mean, this is where a very famous ecologist said about El Salvador, where nature has been destroyed or absolutely obliterated. So I did some work there. I was actually working on developing the environmental legal framework in after the 1992 liberation of El Salvador, and they suddenly then had an environmental minister, but they didn't have any environmental law. So I was asked to come down and help them develop their environmental legislation. And as I was running around, everyone would say, well, you know, we don't have any forest here. And now I, you know, sometimes I don't know what I'm looking at. But there are often times when I can tell the difference between a forest and something else. And so it was a little bit like that joke, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And I said, well, now, wait a minute. If I'm not mistaken, we're driving through a forest right now. Said, no, this just doesn't count. It's just crappy forest. This, you know, we only have some good forest in our national park, and the rest of this, it doesn't. It's not forest. Well, I thought it may not be forest to you, but I bet it's forest to a lot of organisms, including a lot of people who live in them. So what's going on here? So I work a lot with a really wonderful remote sensing guy at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory named Sasan Sachi. And so I said, Sasan, everybody says that there's no forest here, but I know there's tons of forest because I'm driving all over this little place and I can see forest everywhere. Now, it may be that, you know, I don't know, the rum here causes hallucinations, but I don't think so. So we then set up a little project where we just sort of did remote sensing. And what we found, of course, was that instead of where nature has been extinguished, a vibrant process of forest recovery was going on. Now, this turns out to be a kind of more interesting, I think all these stories are very interesting, but it was a lot more interesting than the narrative of kind of the Malthusian narrative of excessive population leading to forest degradation. You still had population densities as high as they had ever been during the peak of deforestation in these rural areas, but now you had total forest recovery. So what was going on? Well, I work with a really great group of people, which is an sort of scientific NGO called Prisma. I urge you to go and look at that website. It's in El Salvador, and it does a lot of studies and a lot of policy on environmental work, but focused on peasant trees and socially progressive kinds of environmentalism, not just simple conservation, which isn't so simple anywhere, but in any case. And what we managed to look to find was the reality that, A, this process was much more widespread through Central America than people had thought. In fact, it's widespread everywhere. It's now called, and it's a minor academic industry, and it's called the... And basically what it argues is that structural changes in the economy...
Susanna, we just missed that. It's called what?
The forest transition. Oop, am I getting...
Yeah, we've got a
call or something coming in
there, yeah.
Okay. Well, it will go away. So the forest transition basically refers to forest recuperation. Now, when I was studying at Berkeley, I had a wonderful forestry professor, Paul Zinke, who also who did a lot of the mapping in forests in Humboldt County. And he used to always say, oh, Susanna, all you do is think about deforestation. But trees grow. So you can have deforestation, but trees, things can come back, you know. And I just humped and said, yeah, well, that's what you think. But, of course, his words came to haunt me when we began to see all through Central America and also in lots of the Amazon as well, about a third of the areas that had been deforested are now in some kind of forest cover, that forests were coming back. Well, how would you explain this? Well, one is that even though population densities are still really high, the out-migration from a lot of Central America, mostly to the U.S., has produced a really dynamic and large remittance economy. And that coupled with the cheap food policies, that is, it's kind of ingrained food dumping into these areas, it's so undercut the value of selling your corn if you produced it compared to buying it in supermarkets or elsewhere that people couldn't get the return on. It was costing them more to produce corn than they could get for it. And so what happened is essentially you lost the regional corn market, which had been part of the deforestation process. Also, there had been a lot of rural land expropriation, so the big fincas, the big cattle farms, had been expropriated, and as part of a land reform, those former grasslands had been given over to other producers. So the result of that was that, one, you didn't have these big livestock holdings, which is really the thing that's most responsible for deforestation. And then you basically had a kind of substitution for money for self-sufficient production. This is another set of questions here. But in the short term, what happens is that these remittances dramatically changed land uses in these areas. It also reflected a larger change about what the meaning of the rural has become in lots of areas in Latin America, which is small farming is not so much a site of production, although it can be. That is, you can have markets for kind of niche products like coffee or mangoes or acai, those kinds of things that are relatively small volume and high management and high value. And those still have an extraordinary dynamism. But in terms of the rural areas as being a site of sort of small farmer production in most of Latin America, that's not as important as it was. Politically, they have become less important because they're not so much producers. But what's important also is that the nature of the rural has changed. It's become part of a safety net for households. It's part of a multi-sited income strategy where you have both urban and rural forms of income. There's this whole economy of regional products that's quite specific and you might not know that much about specific products, but they're important regionally. The other thing is that these areas are also becoming important for environmental services. So if you will, we could sort of see this as a shift from landscapes of production to landscapes of services. Now, in Central America, one thing that's really important is water. So being able to maintain landscapes with trees on them that are good at maintaining watersheds becomes important. So one thing that's happened in El Salvador is where they didn't have, a water tax, if you will, they now do, so that money goes in to support forest management by local populations to maintain watersheds for water supply. So that's one thing that's quite important. The next thing is, of course, they're trying to deal with climate change. So the deal with, we aren't, but everyone else is. So one of the things about environmental services is thinking about how different kinds of peasant-maintained landscapes actually can buffer larger-scale climate change, at least to some degree. The third thing is that these are they're very vibrant matrices. And when I say a matrix, what I mean here is not that great movie, but rather that this is an area which has got a lot of complex ecosystems and different stages of ecosystems in it. And so they actually have a really high level of biodiversity in them. So if you have more landscape complexity, it can kind of support more different kinds of biodiversity. So in a place that's the size of L.A. County, there are 350 species of birds, more or less, in part because it's got mountains and valleys and rivers and, it's got a complex topography. But also it's got a complex of different kinds of landscapes and different kinds of humanly manipulated landscapes that often are kind of windfalls for wild species. I know that your native Mendocinoans up there, as they watch bears and deer munch through their orchards, know that you never know how much biodiversity there is until you start to garden. And in some sense, what you have in Central America is a lot of complex agroforestry systems that both support a lot of wildlife but also support human livelihoods as well. So these come out of long traditions of local knowledge and local management, And those are the kinds of things that are also getting a lot of support. But it's important to realize that there is a big connection, because lots of people in Central America work in California. I bet they work. There's plenty of them working in your very vineyards up there in Mendocino. And those remittances have an impact in that it is contributing to this process of forest recovery. So it's this dynamic between a kind of international capital flow from, if you will, capital from below. There's also the sort of market dynamics of green markets, fair markets, and so on, and also the impact of what we might say is not so such a good thing, but cheap food policies. But cheap food policies, we all love them in our way. It's just that they're complicated. They're destabilizing in a lot of ways. So I would say if we're looking at Latin America right now, what we're seeing is two really kind of exciting trends. And I know I sound like a Pollyanna on this, but because it's not, you know, it's not totally a wonderful story. But there really are, if you're looking at questions about forest trend, you're seeing a lot of deforestation slowing down in lots of areas, and you're seeing a lot of forest resurgence almost everywhere. So it's a pretty good scenario. And one, by the way, that a decade ago you wouldn't have thought about. You would have thought everything is just going to go up in flames and it's all going to be horrible. And what you see is that there's a lot of structural change, political change, institutional change, that's working to sort of support complex ecosystems. But the key thing here, and this is where it's really quite different from how we perhaps normally think about it, is their focus is on inhabited landscapes.
So, Susanna, twice now you've referred to, I guess we might call it environmental policy in Central America in one example, in Brazil in another, and contrasted our own policies, it seems to me, implicitly negatively. What's happening here? You don't have to, you know, get into the nitty-gritty of the detail, but has there been a shift in thinking in Central and South America, or?
I would say, yeah, there's been quite a big shift in thinking. One is that it used to be, I mean, if you sort of are an average American and an average person, and why wouldn't you think this? You have urban areas, you have farms, and then you sort of have wilderness. And Latin America has sort of forest farming in a different kind of way. It's a tropical ecosystem. It's got tons of fruit domesticates. Those systems are agroforestry systems in a lot of ways at different levels of succession, different levels of maturity. But the other thing is that historically, national parks in the American model essentially took what had been indigenous lands or locally owned lands by different kinds of peasant populations and said, gosh, this is so gorgeous, we're going to turn these into parks. This has happened a lot in Amazonia with what are called quilombos, the sort of former slave communities that actually sort of used the forest as a kind of a barrier or a kind of way of hiding, you know. So they have these magnificent forests which are all have a lot of symbolic meaning in them. They have a lot of ritual trees and ritual places and so on. But they're sort of invisible except as having really great biodiversity. So the fact that that biodiversity is not exactly created, but it's a kind of a co-creation of a landscape, both by natural processes and human manipulation to give you kind of this great outcome. And a lot of places would see those. One very famous of one of these is on the Trombetas River, and essentially one of the most famous quilombos in the eastern Amazon was turned into a park, and the people are supposed to leave it. Well, this is another story of indigenous and local or traditional peoples sort of sticking up for their rights. But what you have is historically, park formation was very exclusionary. That is, it took landscapes and basically thought they were empty. This has to do with a lot of ideologies about emptiness, about the tropics, which is that people just would see those forests and think there wasn't anything in them. And then when you tried to chop them down, it would be like, you know, when you're mowing a lawn and there are crickets, you know, people would be sort of jumping out in front of, from all quarters. So the landscapes were more inhabited than a lot of conservationists, I think, realized. And so this made a lot for a more conflict in development circles and conservation circles than people realized. But on the other hand, there's also been movements associated with social movements and different kinds of conservation movements that sort of said, well, you know, if what you want is really great forests and you happen to have people in them, what's the problem here? And so in that sense, what you see is a lot of movement toward what are called sort of sustainable development enclaves, working landscapes with a lot of forest in them. We have these in the United States. If you go into the Northeast, or, you know, you see a lot of working landscapes that have that are heterogeneous, you know. They're a complex matrix that can support a lot of different kinds of organisms. So in essence, what this is a kind of a third way against either sort of industrial agriculture on one hand and empty forests on the other, for a kind of model that looks much more heterogeneous. It looks probably a lot like your landscapes up there. I know it looks a lot now like Humboldt, where you have a lot of people living in these areas, but you also have a lot of different kinds of production. I won't go into it. And you have a lot of forest recuperation at the same time.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host on Talking About California today. Our guest is Professor Susanna Hecht. She's a professor at the University of California in Los Angeles. We've been talking about the environment and forestry and the Amazon and other parts of Central America. If you don't mind, to continue on one of your last points, I sort of feel like I've been caught. I walk up the Jug Handle Trail near my house, and I think, this isn't a forest, this is a mess. But it, you're saying that's maybe the wrong way to look at it. How about helping us a little bit with the problem of deforestation, you know, what forest resurgence is all about, and maybe is that connected to your thoughts on and the reality of climate change?
Well, I think one of the things we want to think about is like this idea of the new rurality, that perhaps what we had been thinking about as kind of production zones are now more zones of services. The other thing is, you know, it does take time for these things to get fixed, and I have to say they sort of fix up faster in the tropics than they do here, in that stuff grows very quickly, and driving through El Salvador now you can see such gorgeous forests, and it's really only been a little less than 20 years when this stuff has started. But one of the things is, actually, if you look at maps of the United States, historic maps, what you see is that it went from being mostly deforested in the mid-19th century to being, you know, quite forested now. So while, of course, there are these dynamics, you know, it'll be more deforested in different as different economic deals move. But there also is, it isn't necessarily a death sentence. That is, forests can come back if you haven't completely wrecked the landscape. So one of the things is that, you know, I know that those post-forest logging things look pretty bad for a while, but if you throw yourself forward a decade or so, they look pretty great, actually. And I know this from my own deforested areas in, not my own, but the ones I know in southern Humboldt County, where, you know, the logging economy kind of finished. And essentially what you have is this resurgence of these forested landscapes. Well, they're sucking in carbon. They're providing habitat. Their root systems are sucking in carbon and storing it. Their little plant bodies are sucking it in and storing it. So there is a younger successional formations actually are better at sucking carbon because they're growing, and they're growing very quickly compared to our mature redwood or our mature pine forests. But in my case, I'm thinking of the Doug Fir, but one of the things that you can say about these things is that in these kinds of dynamics, you do get a fair amount. One, you're storing more carbon in these systems than one thought. And the other thing is that they're dynamic. They really are changing, and they do, you know, they do transform what a landscape looks like. So it's important to realize that things are not given for all time. The other thing is that it's also important to realize that even the urban can have a significant arboreal and biodiversity world. We sort of think of them as not being part of the planet. But I live in Los Angeles, and I can just hear everybody sneering. But I live in Topanga Canyon, which is an area that has a lot of biodiversity in it, as anyone who, if you look at it on a map, you'll see that it's part of the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy that goes all the way from, you know, it's the Sierra Madre. It just goes all the way to Mexico, basically, in these coastal ranges. But within that, it's also in the midst of a giant megalopolis. And, you know, we're all worrying about our mountain lions and the bears. And, you know, I mean, the big joke now is that, you know, the bears are always opening the refrigerators to get the Costco meatballs. So one of the things is that we have to sort of, in the face of climate change, be thinking not just in terms of buying those Priuses, which I'm not thinking in terms of, but rather in creating landscapes that can buffer change and absorb carbon in dynamic and interesting ways. And if that's going to happen, we have to imagine a world in which people and forests coexist. And I think the words of Payakan Kayapo sort of summarize this as well as anything I've ever heard. And his line is always, forests are one big thing. They have plants. They have animals, and they have people.
Okay. We shifted away from your immediate projects a while back, and I did want to ask...
I can go back to that in a snap.
I did want to ask you about your forthcoming book, The Scramble for Africa. We have a little time left.
The Scramble for Amazon.
Scramble for the Amazon. Could you tell us what's happening with that? And then I had one other question before we end that I might have to interrupt you on, but let's start off back with...
The full title is called The Scramble for the Amazon and the Lost Paradise of Euclides da Cunha. Now, Euclides da Cunha, for you who haven't been reading your world literature, is one of the famous writers of Brazil. And he wrote one of his masterpieces, this one book called Rebellion in the Backlands. And it's about how the Brazilian military crushed this millenarian community. And it's one of the most incredible books. Vargas Llosa kind of plagiarized it in the War at the End of the World. But it's a really amazing book, and I really recommend that to everyone. Now, that took place in the dry Brazilian Northeast. But what's not known about so much about da Cunha is that he was part of a survey team and also part of, how do we say, an ideological team for the Baron of Rio Branco during the scramble for the Amazon, which occurred really during the rubber boom. So what the book is about really is that, first of all, people think that there was no scramble for the Amazon. There's the scramble for Africa, of course, everyone's heard about it, but they don't realize there was also a new world scramble for, with the usual guys, the Belgians, the French, the British, the Dutch, as well as hemispheric aspirants like the United States and Peru and Bolivia. So there were a lot of big battles going on and adjudications going on. So one of the things that this is about, it's about the scramble more generally, so you can catch up on your scramble info, but the other thing is it's about this particular one in the end in Acre and in on the Purus River, which included a great a U.S. consortium of who wanted to put in a charter company there and basically have an American colony there. It had a lot of guerrilla warfare going on between Peru and Brazil, and it's a very complicated story. So this is about Acuña's, who spent most of the last part of his life writing about Amazonia. He never published his book that he wanted to call The Lost Paradise. But what I've tried to do is take a lot of his writings about Amazonia and contextualize them in the framework of this scramble, and then have him sort of tell a lot of the story about what was going on. And then, of course, one of the things is that he lives this tragedy, which is a function of his travels to the Amazon, which is his wife runs off with a teenage lover, and eventually Acuña is killed by the young lover, who happened to be the Brazil sharpshooting champion. So errant wives, keep this in mind. Don't get the sharpshooter. and then the sharpshooter also, the sons of Euclides are terribly upset by this and conspire in various ways to kill the husband. You could just read this straight out of Oedipus or Hamlet, actually. And they are undone by the stepfather once again. So it is a really horrible tragedy. But anyway, so there's this sort of dramatic arc of his life and his writings, and he's the best environmental writer you'll ever read. Nobody writes as well about the environment as he does. And it's about the politics of the Amazon at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, and it sort of sets up a framework for, really, Fate of the Forest later on. I envision this as part of a trilogy, so Scramble is the first book, Fate of the Forest the second, and I'm just writing the third book right now, so I don't have a title yet, Amazon Ascension or something like that. So that's what that's about, and it's environmental history and social history in places that have this imaginary of having never had any history. If you go on to environmental websites, they just put in the largest conservation area, the largest binational park on the Purus between Peru and Brazil. It's the size of Costa Rica. It's a huge area. And, you know, they are always gabbing about how, God, this is the most pristine, untouched area. That whole region had at least 17 wars from about 1880 until 1920. So it's not, it wasn't a place that was somewhere at the beginnings of time and outside of history. It was in the middle of 19th century and early 20th century history as the most valuable commodity on the planet, one on which the Industrial Revolution depended, were tapped out of the trees by a labor force of well over a million people. So part of this is to animate, part of the purpose of this, besides that Euclides da Cunha is so wonderful, is to start animating a social history of tropical forests, which have plenty of social history, and to sort of help us think how we go forward, because if we imagine these places as empty, then we're going to be doomed in a certain way. Whereas if we imagine them with a history, then we can come up with interesting solutions, as they have in Brazil, with extractive reserves and various kinds of sustainable use models, also regular conservation as well as indigenous holdings. So in a certain sense, if you give a place a history, it gives you a lot more things rather than pretending that the only history it has is an environmental one, or shall I say an evolutionary one.
Okay, now I think you're getting ready for back to work at UCLA this week. I think that's what you told me. And you're going to be teaching about food systems. How about giving all our students out here?
I'm always happy to
a taste of what's in store for your students.
Well, basically what I do in this is I sort of go from what is perceived to be the most wild and least controlled thing on the planet, which I would say is the ocean. So we go from the most wild to the most tame. So it goes through food systems from fisheries and so on into the urban. So it is one of these things that sort of covers the entire arc of where people get food. And it deals a lot with the politics of food, but it also deals a lot with political ecology and the agroecology of food, because these aren't just, although they may look like industrial systems, they're still biological systems. And sometimes people get, that gets a little bit lost, particularly amongst my planning students who will sort of see them, imagine themselves as, you know, basically just putting up a few farmers markets and calling it a day. Virtuous thing to put up farmers markets, but still. But to think about more broadly how many kinds of ecosystems one affects through one's consumption, but also through other forms of demand, the political ecology of this. This isn't just uniquely about your consumption or my consumption, but also how food systems and food industries actually work in the construction of landscapes and food supply. So that's what I'll be doing. I always have a lot of public health students. Richard Jackson, who some of you guys might know, has done a lot of work on how urban form affects health. So one of the things is that we have a lot of public health people who like to take this class too, because of the nature, the fundamental nature of food supply in the questions and problems now of broader public health.
Okay, so we're just about at the end of this, Susanna. I wanted to remind listeners that they can look for your work in The Fate of the Forests, which is still available from, did you say, University of Chicago?
Yep.
And forthcoming, The Scramble for the Amazon, which is that also University of Chicago?
You bet.
So two there. And anything else you'd like to recommend for people who've been listening to you?
Well, the Spanish version of the book on the impact of migration on natural resources, if you go to the Prisma website, and that's spelled P-R-I-S-M-A, like Prisma, you can download a PDF of that book and for free. It was produced as part of the celebration for 50 years of the Ford Foundation in Latin America, so it was kind of a celebratory thing, but you can get your mitts on that in Spanish. An English version is in the works. I don't know where it actually is in the process. These are these things that move in mysterious ways, and authors are not privy to how these things function. But so anyway, that's that. You can get hold of that. The other two you can get on Amazon, or urge your private local bookstore to carry them. And so you can go in and see all sorts of other things that you might like to get your mitts on as well.
All right. This has really been brilliant this morning, Susanna, and I think we're all going to be a bit envious of your students this fall. So thanks for taking your time.
You say that now. Just wait till you hear my students howling.
Well, we'll look them up. Anyway, thanks for taking the time out of what obviously is a very busy life to talk to us here in Mendocino County. My name's Cal Winslow. I've been talking to Professor Susanna Hecht. She's a senior professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA. I'm going to be back on the air again next week at this time, next Thursday at 9 a.m. So thanks, Susanna, and good morning, listeners.